Welcome to the ANews podcast. This is episode 102. This podcast covers anarchist activity, ideas, and conversations from the previous week on Anarchist News. It's designed to be useful to anarchists and the anarcho-curious. Give us feedback and constructive criticism by email at podcast@anarchistnews.org. For more information and usually some good commentary, go to the nonsectarian anarchistnews.org. Recently, It's Going Down did a podcast entitled Hard Pill to Swallow, Mapping a Response to the Opioid Crisis, where they interviewed an anarchist whose response to said crisis involves outreach, lobbying, and education around opioid addiction. The intention of this podcast was, as the title would suggest, to begin to map out what a grassroots, community-based, and autonomous response to the crisis might begin to look like, unquote. These are pretty ambitious goals, ones I wouldn't expect anyone to satisfy in the space of 40 minutes, but by the end of it, they managed to come up with some action points for their action-minded audience that included getting a hold of Narcan and getting trained to use it. As practical advice goes, for a person who's likely to encounter someone overdosing on opioids, this is probably sound. However, I'm not sure where ideas, however vague, like grassroots, community-based, and autonomy come in here. Take the use of Narcan, for example. Even the term is a brand name for naloxone, which exists as medication manufactured by pharmaceutical companies, regulated by the government, and sold by retailers or distributed by various nonprofit entities. Where is the autonomy in using a medication like this? What is grassroots about the training you're likely receiving from a nonprofit organization, perhaps funded by grants from CDC? Part of the trouble with IGD's line of attack, which sees anarchists as filling the gaps where a state, mostly interested in punishing people, and companies, mostly interested in exploiting people, fall short of the limited assistance they offer, is that it misses that the Narcan they're prescribing is entirely meshed within that system. The fact that we can attain it as cheaply and easily as we can is a product of massive amounts of public and private money being shifted toward opioid crisis management. Short of manufacturing it ourselves, more ambitious ideas such as stealing it or establishing groups outside of the nonprofit system where anarchists teach each other about using and distributing it, don't escape the fact that our access to naloxone is ultimately dependent upon its manufacture by pharmaceutical companies. If we're going to play the service provision game, the unfortunate truth is that nonprofit entities and organs of the state are often better at this than we are by almost every measure. More money, more resources, better capacity for distribution, stronger relationships with members of the same community that service-oriented anarchists are attempting to court, and longer-running commitments to the areas in which they exist than the vast majority of our projects. Even our more successful examples of this model, such as Common Ground in New Orleans, which found itself in a unique position during a natural disaster and was literally going where none of these other groups would go, tend to either fold or find themselves subsumed within the formal nonprofit model once their moment in the sun is over. Too often, in our attempts to win over the normal people we encounter in service projects, we bend over backwards trying to put a friendly face on our politics or hide them entirely, and in doing so compromise any anarchist character we intended for our project. Here, I'd suggest that we spend a little more time thinking about what an anarchist response to a capital C crisis entails. I'm not referring here to personal crises or interpersonal crises as in attempting to respond to an addiction or overdose by oneself or among a small circle of acquaintances. A capital C crisis serves two functions: rallying attention as something which must be responded to, and setting resources in motion, money, people, goods, toward resolving said crisis. A capital C crisis is a mix of political rhetoric and big, ungainly numbers collected by authorities of some sort or another and placed into categories for purposes of management and funding. Numbers of addicts, numbers of deaths by overdose, etc. Responding to a capital C crisis tends to involve a range of measures, including punishment and service provision, to a large pool of mostly strangers. And while this framing is often used by the state, it isn't exclusive to it. One need only look at the rhetoric around Trump's election and the rise of the alt-right to see how many crises anarchists have constructed in the recent past. It's tempting to respond to the call of a crisis, especially when it's ravaging another capital C, the community, but why should we? Is it good PR for a marginal ideology, a chance to do good and feel like a hero, the sense that perhaps it's going down, trademark, and this is a chance to show people the limits of the state's capacity to care for them? Or is it just good old obligation? Again, I would suggest that the terrain of crisis isn't the best place for anarchists to raise their flag. The scale is too large, our capacity far too small. Naloxone distribution doesn't even touch the surface of where opioids and drugs tainted with them are coming from, never mind why some people might be consciously destroying their life through drug use or have a life so empty or painful that they don't care if they die or not. Faced with such a daunting task, my suggestion would be that anarchists either give it the response it deserves or do not respond to it at all. Either way, I'd suggest beginning with an honest assessment of one's desires and capacity for achieving them. It also means recognizing that Big C crisis response often gives rise to lots of silly, exhausting behavior that runs unfortunately parallel to how many nonprofits act, including jumping from crisis to crisis with little regard for one's actual capacity to act, except you're not getting grant money for it, days running gauntlets of meetings, except you're not getting paid to attend them, attending symbolic events that usually don't achieve their aims, except you're not getting arrested on purpose, and almost inevitable burnout through obligatory action for the greater good. The cross of some tens of thousands of deaths is too much for any of us to bear, and the sooner we realize this, the better. What's new this week? The International Anarchist Defense Fund, from freedomnews.org.uk. This is a statement about the one-year anniversary of this project that wants to do a good thing, support anarchists and anarchist-related folks who are suffering bullshit because of their politics. Quote, "We tend to forget that repression reaches further than directly targeted people that end up in jail. Oftentimes, we disregard those who get, quote, simple fines, or get away from the police but end up battered, or those who are families of directly repressed who have health or mental issues after interactions with the state repression, saying nothing of people on the run who have to live underground for years or for their whole life. The latter cannot just write publicly about it, asking others to send them money to where they are hiding, and neither can the comrades who would like to help but don't want to demonstrate that they know the whereabouts of the wanted comrade," unquote. Of course, this type of fund is an uphill battle at the best of times, as anonymity is a part of it, and anonymity and money are a difficult mix. The fact that the project has lasted a year is not nothing. The goals are noble. But even if everyone currently involved is totally ethical, there doesn't seem to be anything keeping some really, really bad guy from coming in and screwing it all up. A conundrum.
Five times Zabate proved he was Franco's public enemy number one. From LibCom Blogs by Ed. A blog post recounting five exploits of Zabate, from daring escapes to coasting and maintaining his social cred. It's nice when anarchist criminals are safely in the past and we can comfortably enjoy their adventures.
Inside Front, International Journal of Hardcore Punk and Anarchist Action, from CrimeThink. A collection of old hardcore music and lyrics from a previous time. I cannot do better than to quote the first post on the comment thread. Quote, "Thanks for the PDF, but it's always a little embarrassing when old heads claim punk is dead because it isn't how they remember it when they were 17 and impressed by everything. People still ride trains in 2019, by the way, and I've heard that some people in the 90s had jobs. But what do I know? All I do is post videos of myself doing poppers on my Instagram story. Punk is, as it ever was, a subculture without hardly any revolutionary potential. Sorry, party, oops, I mean block, membership is down. But some interesting cultural consequences," unquote. Adorable, right?
J20 Postscript, How I Spent January 20th, 2017, from CrimeThink, of course. This is the continuing saga of J20 from multiple perspectives. This one features a magical realism style. Other than that, it's a play-by-play with little analysis. Quote, "This scene, not the White House, is truly the center of the nightmare, whence come all the other horrors. The police are not needed here, not in such numbers anyway. The absence of an alternative does their work. The dreamlessness itself is the police. It is what imposes the nightmare. For the first time, we look at each other, you and I. What is our dream? What will transport us unscathed through the lines of riot police? Where do we want our burning limousine to take us? Where do we want to go?" Unquote.
To the Captives, from Wild Resistance, previously known as the Black and Green Review, by Kevin Tucker. 24 pages. This is classic KT writing, rambling journal, full of assertions to be taken on faith, with infrequent bits of actual information scattered like a few needles in a pin factory. This piece seems to be, at bottom, an explanation of why the change in jargon, from anarcho-primitivism to primal anarchy, from Black and Green Review to Wild Resistance, and a defense of anarcho-primitivism's ideas, which are correct, TM. He also says that it isn't semantic, but a significant shift. Let me leave it at this. Kevin desperately needs an editor. He needs to consider who his audience is, i.e. other anarchists, other primitivists, normies off the street, because he's way too basic and repetitive for some of those people and way too jargony for others. 24 pages. Yeesh.
New repressions against Russian anarchists. Solidarity needed. From Anon. Russian anarchists are still and again getting harassed and tortured. Send money. Quote, in the police station of Balashiha, Moscow region, Galkin saw Azad. He was threatened by the FSB officers and had his arms wrung. According to Galkin, Azad did not look like a human being from being tortured. He also said he heard screams of one of the arrested women activists who was kept in the room next to his. He also heard that one of the arrested anarchists, Azad, cut his veins and took some pills in order to avoid further torture and thus avoid giving any information about other comrades, unquote. There's a PayPal information to send money.
Did the FSB use a neo-Nazi agent provocateur in their case against Russian anti-fascists? From Open Democracy. This article is mostly the English translation of an article from an independent Russian newspaper, making the case that the FSB did indeed use a neo-Nazi mole against Russian anti-fascists and anarchists. Quote, having introduced himself as Vlad Dobrovolsky, the agent encouraged them to take radical measures against the Russian authorities and engage in violent acts against law enforcement officials. Shakursky's statement was filed to senior investigator Valery Tokarev and attached to the case files. But this evidence was not verified by law enforcement. Unquote. There is also more information about the trial and about evidence manufacture and torture, you know, in case the previous stories were not enough.
Organizing some ideas about Venezuela from Indie Media Venezuela by Lucia Lotta. This only barely squeaks into this podcast and onto anarchistnews.org, as it is about statecraft, and the only mention of anarchism is about how social reconstruction needs to happen through its ideas? Huh? Oh, right. Different anarchism. Given all the positive media, nationally and internationally, in support of getting rid of Maduro and installing the new kid, it's hard not to be suspicious of this piece, even if it does come from an indie media project. Quote, Venezuela needs to undertake a path of social reconstruction, a peaceful exit of social justice and of reconciliation. In Venezuela, from the Caracazo, impunity has been order. The time has come for the murderers of the country to pay, those of yesterday and today. We should also remember that voting is another tool, and in the Venezuelan case, today it is necessary because we are talking about repression and death. I also support the need to talk about direct democracy, economic self-management, municipalism, etc. The social reconstruction needs to happen through the ideas of anarchism. Unquote.
Audio and video. Anarchy Radio, February 5th, 2019. An hour. The only thing this episode is interesting for are the times that Jay-Z hypothesizes with no apparent, or at least no stated, evidence for his theories. In this case, the most blatant example is his conjecture about why Derek Jensen's book might not have come out because of its libelous commentary. Jay-Z's one concession to the possibility of evidence? He says he's not the only one to think this. So convincing. Maybe Fox News thinks it's true, too. Oh, one other amusing thing. Jay-Z mentions the change of name from Black and Green Review to Wild Resistance, and Kevin Tucker's adoption of primal anarchy instead of anarcho-primitivism. Jay-Z mentions that this change happened, quote, for some reason, unquote. SMH.
Anarchy Bang, introducing Episode 5, Urban versus Rural, 2 hours. Quote, this week we talk about the dream, for many, many anarchists, of moving back to the land, and how it has worked out for those who have done it. Wouldn't getting away from all the shit be great? What is that shit? Are there more fun anarchist activities happening there rather than here, or is it in fact the opposite? Unquote. Call started out with noted troll, death threatener and lost boy Zachev, who proves here that he is capable of being reasonable, at least occasionally. Multiple calls again this week, although Aragorn did find time to bring up some of the info bits he's been planning on. Fewer tech issues. A yippee!
Anarchy Bong, Episode 6. Half an hour. Some folks hang out, give one semi-funny dig at Aragorn along the lines of rejecting talk of definitions, and subscribe to identity politics. Only women are allowed to get upset about certain kinds of lyrics. I believe the intention was sound, but execution, people! Remember, actual funny is hard. Or maybe I just don't have a sense of humor. Could be.
Primal Anarchy Podcast 16, Book Recommendations Part 1, an hour and a half. If Tucker's very calm and soothing voice doesn't put you to sleep, there are some funny bits in here. Like, he appreciates the feedback, but the most important thing is to spread the word because there are so few anarchist places for his products. Maybe, for that to be funny, you need to know that he refuses to send some anarchist projects his titles, since the projects don't meet his standards. He also reads the few lines that are apparently the important bits of his captive's essay to explain why the name changes. And then he talks about events. So, sort of like the extended version of Jay-Z's show, with less New York Times.
Ah! topic of the week. Let's get organized. Someone once told me that I should only begin projects I can complete by myself. Organizing is the antithesis of such advice. The preferred method of bringing ideas to life for the organizer is a church-like mass. The focus becomes the abacus, the task itself is secondary, and as a result leaves a vacancy easily filled by fantasy. The greater the fantasy, the more powerless the individual, and the more reliant on the organizer they become. If you were to organize your thoughts into objectives you alone could achieve, your activities may begin to resemble ordinary life under capitalism. Without the fantasies, would you still be doing anarchism? Without the bravado of clandestine plans, would you still be an anarchist? Is it necessary for anarchy that we boast ideas of grandeur to a mass of co-conspirators? How can anarchists celebrate a life built on their individual capabilities alone, even if that means never experiencing insurrection? Aragorn, I give you a hot ball of mess.
That was an abrupt ending. So I guess there's a bunch of things in there that I think are worth exploring. I'm just not sure the context of the way in which it was framed sort of leads us in a direction. So why don't we go into a couple different... why don't we follow the threads rather than try to make sense of the quilt?
So, well, that's good, because that's not going to happen.
So the first one is this distinction between sort of our capacity to do projects as individuals versus our capacity to do them as a team or something.
Correct.
And one thing that I've definitely found in anarchist projects is that to the extent to which you spend a lot of time building the team to have, like, the same vision or whatever, that can be a real waste of time. Like, if there isn't some sort of, like, cultural sense that you're sharing that exemplifies itself in the context of a project, then, you know, like, just to give two different examples, there was this group that we were a part of that never really got off the ground called Group X. And it ostensibly was trying to sort of be a clearinghouse for brand new anarchists to come to town to be able to get into the mix.
Right.
That was one of the visions. And definitely, like, you know, the group broke down, like a lot of similar groups break down, because the very construction of the group reflected the values of the organizers, which were, we'll just say, for lack of better language, white people versus what other people thought was a useful organization to create, which of course were people of color who were not part of the original organizing committee, but of course were still in the room.
Right.
And so really what you saw was a clash of different cultures and a lack of, I'm not sure if you want to say clarity or like constitution on the part of the original white organizers to not stand up for their own vision of what it was that they were trying to build. In other words, it's absolutely fair for people to say this organizing group is never going to work out because we weren't part of it, and for the original group to say, well, then move on. Create your own group. Anyways, and you compare that to, we had a group of friends who entered into this Group X group. How many times can I say group in a sentence? But we had a body of people, we'll say a half dozen, but it was a bit more than that, who were very close friends, who we could appreciate how sort of farcical and funny the entire series of events that happened were, because we had the cultural context and the years spent together to be able to sort of like nod at each other and shake our heads and sort of see the same points of conflict. So to restart this conversation and put it in the context of the topic of the week, And I feel like this happens a lot of times with the topic of the week, where you don't want to give details of a particular thing that you were involved in or name names or whatever. And so as a result, you continue to use all these terms that basically are so abstract that it's extremely hard to understand what it is that you're talking about. I have a suspicion as to what I think that this person's talking about because I know who they are and because I sort of have been around them ranting and raving about what they're upset about today. But you couldn't get that at all out of this.
Oh.
So, oftentimes, we find ourselves, and I can definitely, I know that this is true in the context of Group X. Group X hates the fact that I'm basically one of the only people that speaks publicly about Group X 15 years later, more than almost 20 years later, and no one, funny. None of the original organizers of Group X have sort of talked about it because they've moved on to their next organizing task and moved out. Well, but in the case of Group X, I mean, many of those people were central to Oscar Grant stuff around. and the Occupy stuff. In other words, like, I'm referring to basically a malformed event from a long time ago that I can use as an example.
Right,
and then I stopped. It's a good example. And then I stopped working with those people because I basically disagreed with the context of how it is that they were going to frame pretty much every organizing project that they've done ever since. But I also disagreed with Group X. That was just a time where I was willing to be a bit more experimental,
right,
and open-minded to sort of like to see where something would go. And in that particular case, they hadn't figured out their line as to how to deal. And I will say that while my approach would be to say, you know, in a new organizing group, I'm not going to invite people who are going to do the classic POC intervention. In fact, they did not take that lesson away from their Group X organizing. And every group that they've done since has involved a lot more people of color very early on in their organizing efforts. And I think to greater or lesser success. Anyway, so that's one of the things that this topic brings up to me. Is this idea of, like, you know, instead of talking about organizing, which, you know, obviously activist types use the term organizing in this really foul way, rather than respond to that with a sort of same vocabulary, I think it's pretty meaningful to just change the conversation. And to the extent to which this person is trying to do that, at the very end of the topic, they basically talk about insurrection. And I do think that for anarchists that have come into the world in the last 15 years, insurrection is this sort of universally good word, where the Oscar Grant riots, for instance, are referred to as being an insurrectionary moment. Moments around Occupy are referred to as being insurrectionary moments. But in fact, they've been changing the definition and the sensibilities behind the term insurrection to sort of mean activism when it succeeds. And that's terrible. That's horrible. And I think that any time you sort of give a word that's sort of like carte blanche to mean good and really good and politically good, mm-hmm. like insurrection has been used now for a long time, mm-hmm. it just impoverishes the word. And so the idea of me or anyone saying that my goal in any activity is to experience insurrection, it's like... It's like what they're really trying to say is Godhead.
Well, I mean, Godhead is absolutely implied in the entire
topic.
The entire topic, yeah, in multiple places. Group X is a particular example because it was so large, right?
There were like at least 50 people in the room.
But I actually think more even at the really big meetings where everyone was there, and. Trying to do anything on a scale that big is hard, just bottom line. Which is why I don't do things on scales that big. Because all of the ways that it's hard are, you can't do a lot about it, as far as I'm concerned. So, okay, if I'm going to take your approach, it is my inclination to do everything by myself, mm-hmm. because fuck you people, I don't need anything from anybody, and I can do it alone.
I mean, fundamentally, and this sort of is a continuation of last week, Little Black Cart has evolved, taking many of the lessons that we learned from consensus decision making,
uh-huh.
and more or less stripping it down to these more bare bones parts.
It's true.
And it's because of this logic.
That's true. But of course, the reality is that you can't do everything by yourself. And I also have very disappointingly come to discover that my brain works better when I have other people to bounce off of. There's a creative spark that I get in a room that I'm not capable of creating on my own. And so I definitely lean towards groups, working with other people, but they're always small and they're always, those people are always known quantities going in. And so I have a full comprehension of the fact that there's a baseline that we share. There's a dictionary that we share, mm-hmm. or glossary, if you will. And that simplifies a whole host of things.
Also, having the experience of trust, like of having an, yeah, just can I trust you?
Sure.
What you say is right. Actually what you're going to do.
Right.
And this, of course, is at the heart of like what our internship program has been about. Is basically, what do you do when a person who ostensibly agrees with you politically, when you put them to the test of actually doing what they say?
Right. And I actually used to think that you could work with people who you did not necessarily like or you did not necessarily trust, as long as that relationship was really clear. And my multiple attempts to do that and be clear about that relationship. I don't like you and I don't trust you, but I see that you have this skill and you are useful in this area, and I'm willing to put that aside so that we can accomplish a thing together. That never ends well, because...
Well, not never, but it definitely... Yeah. Most of the time it's true.
Yeah, people don't respond well to that. I thought people would appreciate the clarity, but mostly people were just offended and surprised.
Yes.
Like, what do you mean you don't like me? You don't like me either. There's no... What are you talking about? And yeah, I don't know. What's hard about the topic of the week here is that I wouldn't ever say any of these things. Wouldn't you ever use any of this language to talk about my politics, my anarchy, what I care about, why I do what I do, what I'm looking for, what I desire. So, yeah, I'm not really sure what else to say. And now I feel bad because I feel like the bare bones of this conversation we've had before.
Of course.
And so now we're just rehashing old and not bringing anything new. So I keep looking at the topic of the week, trying to figure out what bit of this I can grab onto and actually engage with as it's written, just to go somewhere else. And I don't know.
Well, let's respond to it in a different way.
Okay.
The subtitle of IGD, It's Going Down, is Choosing Sides and Getting Organized.
Okay.
So in some way, this topic of the week is responding or in a dialogue with that concept.
Okay.
And we know that concept, or conceptually we believe that concept is sort of the excellent American response to the French Tycoon or Invisible Committee sort of perspective. Choosing sides, getting organized. So this is very American. It says, let's just get organized.
Ah. Okay.
Right. And I think a lot of people believe that the first step to, like, doing effective anarchist projects is getting organized. What do they mean? And mostly, of course, they're inexperienced people. But what do they mean when they say that?
What do they mean when they say, let's get organized? Well... I haven't been around those people in a long time.
Yeah.
My experience of those people, and I'm just going to like basically kind of sort of tell a story. My direct experience of those people is that they are usually college kids, and their education has given them a very particular vision for laying out a plan, plotting the various points that you need to get from A to Z. Z is quite concrete. The points in between are a combination of the way things should work and the compromises they have to make based on what's around them. And then you have a blueprint. And now all you'll have to do is build. And that's what organization means. I'm not saying that's true for everyone. And that example is... ...18 years old?
Sure.
So...
I mean, there used to be a thing that we would joke around about, which was this anti-racist group that did workshops to other activists and organizers. And a lot of what they did was develop the language around what they meant by activist and organizer. And for them, the word organizer was very important. Basically, when you when a baby activist grew up, they became an organizer.
Yeah.
And when they took their class, they became like, you know, like absolutely, they became an organizer.
You were certified.
Yeah, they became like organizer plus, like organizer plus, not racist. So
you only need one class, folks.
Yeah, so it's a, so, sort of a different cadence or context than the French version or the Americanized French version.
Yes.
But there's something here where the word organized has grown to fill every gap. Mostly, it seems to be a substitute for get on the same page.
Yes.
Become politically strong.
Woke.
Like, well, but mostly like it's about the same pageness of it. Like for instance,
are you implying that in the word organize is the concept of choosing sides already?
Yeah, I think that that's fair.
Okay.
But it's definitely about a model of what social change looks like and what our role in social change looks like.
Okay.
So, you know, the idea of being led by people of color would be the kind of thing an organizer would understand, but an activist might not.
Oh, I understand. I see what you're saying.
So in this more... And so then how does all that nuance look in the context of the American version of the French? And then in this case... You know, as we know, SUDS, because of former topics of the week, sort of is the more like they define projects in more of like business terms than a lot of other people.
All right.
And so what do they mean by getting organized? I think it's actually somewhat similar, that the first step is getting some people who are on the same page.
Okay.
Right, but the thing that's strange about this is like, so we poo-poo it, but we poo-poo it largely because we're already there.
No, I'm not even saying that I poo-poo it. I'm just, I am not poo-pooing it. But I don't, and yes, we are already there because we have spent the last 20 years of our life trying to get there. And being very intentional about it. I am suspicious of the language and the framing being so important.
Hmm. So how would you say it without it being so precious in terms of the terminology?
I don't know. That's a long thought process for me because I just don't, like, this is not how I operate in my daily life. And part of it is because of, I don't have to, right?
Right. You have a comfortable cultural context where you don't have to be organized because, you know, without the word, we already are.
Right. So, yeah. But I also want to be, I don't want to be dismissive of people who are trying to figure out these things in their lives.
No, for sure.
Because when you're young, of course, these things are harder.
Or new.
And I also can't, I cannot imagine what it looks like for so much of your political world to be framed by the online world.
Sure.
Right? So it's not real, quote unquote, as in, you know, you can't touch those people, you can't see those people, you can't like that interaction. So then to then kind of bring that into meet space, I am wholly baffled by that concept. So I don't want to be snarky to people who are trying to navigate that.
Of course.
Because that sounds horrible and undesirable to me.
No, I mean, the trick is, how does one talk about these terminologies and the histories of these terminologies without being entirely off-putting to someone who's just experimenting with them for the first time? Because right. because everyone does have to figure it out themselves, even if we can warn them away from the most obvious pitfalls.
No, all of that's absolutely true.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Welcome to Redacted. This is Suds, and this week I am going to be starting with some bad news. We have lost someone close to us, and I hate to be the person to break it to everybody, but the last time that we had an episode of Redacted, someone commented on the article on Anarchist News and said that if we ever had another segment again on the A News podcast, they were going to have to leave forever. So, Anonymous, you will be greatly missed. In the meantime, for the rest of us, we're going to be continuing on with the one-on-ones. And this time, I am going to be joined by Squee, who will be interviewing me about my past and anarchism moving on into the new year. For this evening, I am going to be enjoying a very delicious vintage of King Cobra. And Squee, what is going to be your drink for this evening?
Well, Suds, today's cocktail of the month is made from Dewar's Scotch, Saint Germain, a dash of bitters, and lime juice.
Damn, that sounds good.
It is quite delicious.
And, you know, for the show, I'm going to be handing the reins over to you. So I think now would be a good time for us to jump in.
That sounds good to me. So considering that the last episode of Anarchy Bang was about the urban and rural divide, where would you say that you spent your childhood? Was it in suburbs? Was it in the country? Were you in the city? What was going on there?
Yeah. I had kind of a mixture. So I was born up in New England. And while I was living there, I was moving around pretty frequently. I had moved to a new city over the years because while I had a background that could be comparable to middle class half of the year, due to my father having a decent contracting position, being like sort of a software engineer, he was just as good at spending money as he was at making it. And so the other half of the year was my mother taking on newspaper routes at 3, 4 a.m. for extra cash, her waking up to him taking money out of her purse, and these other sorts of things. And so the childhood that I was raised in was one that was constantly on the move. And as a lot of the tech world changed up in New England, it kind of forced my family to move down to North Carolina. And so I had kind of moved from this suburban New England lifestyle into this sort of isolated country lifestyle down in North Carolina, surrounded by the sort of like right-wing but left-leaning family of my mother's side, who, you know, now I consider to be my own family. But I think one of the things that's really important to bring up too, especially in the context of where I come from, because it's been such a challenge for me, especially in my conversations with Aragorn and in my own readings and in my own development, is, you know, when I was up in New England, I had grown up in a Christian school, in a very small one. There were about 200 students from kindergarten all the way up through 12th grade. And when I moved down to North Carolina, it was my first time entering into the public school system.
Yeah. And what kind of student were you? Were you a good student? Were you a troublemaker? What was...
I was a non-student. I went through eighth grade year kind of normal. And then when I went into high school, it was a matter of weeks before I was ditching school and spending all of my time in the woods that surrounded the property. And so, you know, I had moved down when I was 14. I had run away with two of my friends when I was 15 and lived in the woods of North Carolina. We were on our way to California, but got arrested in Texas, which I don't think was any small feat since we started on the East Coast. But shortly after my return, I had dropped out and entered into the work world just as soon as I could.
And were you driving when you ran away, or was this all hitchhiking or hopping trains, or what was?
I wish it was around? That romantic. Huh? No, what we did was, so during the same time period that I was in school, the two people I ran away with, we all worked in this haunted house that one of my friends was running. And so we had been saving up money all of the month of October, and you know, it was all under the table, so we had plenty of cash in our pocket. And so at the end of that, when we did run, you know, we had been spending all this time going around the school and telling all of our friends all of these different stories, so that once the cops came and started investigating everyone, what they were receiving were all these like conflicting tales of where it was that we had gone. And we had also been hiding a bunch of our stuff in the woods outside the school, so that once we were ready to go, we already had everything there waiting for us. And so, you know, we didn't finally run away until very early November, and it had already started getting cold, even for North Carolina. And so after a short period of time, I would say probably about 2 weeks living out in the woods in the cold, we decided to spend what little money we had on Greyhound tickets to California, and found that we only had enough money basically to get us to Texas. So once we got there, well, I didn't get sick, but the girls that I was traveling with did. And we just ended up finding ourselves in trouble and brought too much attention to ourselves. And so it isn't as grand a tale as hopping trains or hitchhiking or anything like that, but certainly a grand tale in my own mind.
So you weren't even of voting age yet. What got you into thinking about politics, or even, you know, specifically about anarchism?
I think it was a mixture of things. I think, like many anarchists, what drew me into it was meeting a figure of authority and finding myself in a position where this is someone who I thought had legitimate authority, and they had broken that trust with me, and that would be my father. And so then when I found myself in the public school system, it had just kind of continued to repeat. And so during my early upbringing, my mother had always been pretty leftist, and my father, I would say, would have been a traditional American conservative. And so around the dinner table, there were often debates and these kinds of things. And so I was politically aware. And yet during this whole time period, you know, much of what me and these two people I ran away with were discussing was really a sort of anarchistic outcome. But we just didn't have the words to describe it. We just knew that the school, that the world that our parents wanted us to enter into, which at the time would have been sort of the beginning of trying to usher in all of these kids into the education bubble that we're seeing in the United States, which luckily I dodged. And really just trying to experiment on our own amongst ourselves with what might exist as an alternative to these sorts of things. And without even really knowing that land projects were a point of discussion among anarchists, I mean, that was really what myself and my two friends had in mind. We wanted to hit the road, go to California, meet people where it was warm, and then figure out how we could make a life in the woods. And this is us at 14, 15 years old.
So when did you start reading about anarchism and actually becoming familiar with the literature?
Yeah. I think it was later on in my teens. You know, after I was arrested in Texas and brought back to North Carolina, I made a promise to my mother that I wouldn't hit the road anymore and that I would actually try and at least keep it together for her. And so, you know, I found myself in the working world and all of these kinds of things and spent a lot of time online because, again, I wasn't really connecting. I think that there was an obvious kind of culture shock that can exist when someone who grew up in New England moves down to the South. And so finding my way down there was a challenge, or down here, I guess I should say. And so I started meeting people on different online forums and email groups and all this kind of stuff. And one of the people I had come across was this girl who had been train hopping for many, many years. And she had gotten kind of tired of it after some violent encounters that she experienced and decided to join the army. And so North Carolina, we have Fort Bragg, which is a pretty significant army base. And she and I started talking. We've been playing Yahoo pool and all of these kinds of things like before she arrived. And so when I went down to the barracks to start hanging out with her, that's when a lot of the conversations kind of started. Like my very close friend and I decided to take this bike trip from the top of North Carolina down to the bottom to Myrtle Beach, and it was fantastic. And so about the time that I started hanging out with her, I was feeling like it was time for me to get back on the road again. And I had mentioned to her, you know, I kind of wanted to make a lifestyle out of it, that I didn't feel as though the sort of sedentary life or the city life or the rural country life was for me. Like I felt like I really needed to be constantly on the move to feel as though my life was being fulfilled. And she, of course, remembering these sort of violent situations that she had been in, warned me and said, you know, this is not something that I think that you should do. Like, please don't. Because not everyone out there is a nice anarchist like you. And so suddenly I had this word that I could apply to the life that I had been leading, and one that I could share with my friends. And you know, for someone who kind of grew up with one foot outside of growing up with the internet and one foot inside of it, because I can remember a time before the internet, where my friends and I were going and finding trouble on our bikes, and going out and just, you know, basically just finding adventure. And then I also remember times where I was hopping online and meeting people from all over the place and how exciting it was and how powerful it was to have a word that you could use that when you plugged into a search engine, essentially opened up this whole world for one person to explore what other potential lives might look like.
And what were you finding online at the time when you were searching for anarchism? Because as far as I can remember, it actually, you know, wasn't really a big footprint on the internet.
No, it was small. It was very small. I mean, for much of anything that was on the internet at the time, it was all very small communities of people. So I'm trying to think about what I actually found online. I think what ended up happening was I ended up finding myself into the punk scene that way. So I was researching anarchism and discovering punk. And in doing so, found myself in North Carolina, going out to these different events that CrimeThink had going on, and going out to these different punk shows where actually some different anarchist distributors, CrimeThink included, had different tables that they had set up with literature and all these kinds of things. And so I would actually say it was more like the internet introduced me more to the music as a way of finding myself in the subject that I wanted to be in. And so it was a very interesting time because, you know, again, with growing up with just a left, right bent to much of my political upbringing, to find myself in what I guess I'll call old crime think, it was very post-left. You know, it was a challenge to the idea that there needed to be this left-right dichotomy, because crime think at the time was really introducing a lot of ideas that stepped outside of that.
Right. So once you started realizing or calling yourself an anarchist, what did that change? What you started doing with your life, or did you just kind of keep going on traveling around, or did you wind up getting into any kind of activism? What happened after that point?
I did. It was a mixture of all of those things. I found myself in a job where I was getting paid more money than I knew what to do with. And the way that it was set up is we were working 14-hour days, 2 weeks straight, and then I'd be out of work for another month. But in North Carolina at the time, I was getting a two-bedroom townhouse for $600 a month and living there by myself with as much money as I was making, right?
Right.
Wow. And so tell me about it. Like I'm back in North Carolina now a decade later and just like that doesn't exist anymore. And so I had plenty of money because Greyhound, also something that doesn't exist anymore, had this program where if you gave them 2 weeks notice that you wanted to travel to a place, it was only $75 regardless of where it was that you were going. And that was round trip.
What do you mean Greyhound doesn't exist anymore?
No. This particular ticket special that existed back then no longer exists. The sort of like this 2 week $75 deal is no longer in existence. And that's honestly how I spent a lot of my time off. Was I was using North Carolina as a sort of home base and then traveling around from place to place with all of my extra cash and living a lifestyle that didn't really require a whole lot of expenditure, meeting different friends that I had made online, and sort of a unique sort of experience because for whatever reason, I had been making a lot of military friends. And so not only was I going to different cities, but I was finding myself in different military bases and really getting a chance to see like this whole other side of the US culture that I think a lot of folks, at least from the anarchist background, don't really get an opportunity to experience.
Yeah, that would be something interesting to talk about. I would even think to dedicate a whole segment to, because, you know, there is a very large portion of the population that goes through some version of the military and they stay connected with the friendships and the mindset and the, you know, the attitudes that they form through it. And, you know, it's definitely something that doesn't enter into conversations a lot when people talk about America.
It's not. And it's a huge culture.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, because I work in IT, I wind up meeting a lot of people from the military that they came out with some, you know, basic IT skills, and that's the jobs they're able to get. And they all still maintain like a very close knit, like buddy kind of thing. And yeah, they have their whole, all their own shit. Anyway. So, what were some of the first, you know, specifically anarchist events that you wound up going to? I know you mentioned the Crime Think was organizing what, punk shows, or what was going on there?
No, they had like the really, really free market that was going on at the time. I think the first in the US was actually in Chapel Hill, which was just a stone's throw from where I was living at the time. I think that a lot of what was happening was I was running into anarchists at what I would call like counterculture events. So it wasn't anarchist events per se, but like an Against Me show or like an anti-Nazi protest, or at the time before they closed their doors, internationalist books would have different talking events whenever like Rolling Thunder would have a new issue released. And so I'd go there and end up debating with members of Crime Think and whoever else was showing up until the sun went down. But really the most influential event I would say in my past before moving to the West Coast was the Southeast Anarchist Network. And that, I mean, I really could spend a whole lot of time talking about, and so I'll attempt not to, but.
Well, let's give the listeners a brief overview of what the what that network was, at least as far as the type of politics that that they mostly consider themselves a part of. As far as I'm aware, most of the stuff in the East Coast is very red and black.
It was, and it still was at the time. And, you know, I was coming from a very post-left standpoint. As soon as I was introduced to it, that's really what I stuck to. And Crime Think was present at the event. And basically the way that it worked was they months in advance, flyers started showing up all over the Southeast in the United States. And in this one particular town, I believe it was in South Carolina, I want to say, they had taken over what used to be a public school that was now abandoned in this neighborhood. And not like condemned, but just not in use. And so they had gotten permission to use it. It was all very well organized because we had people from really all over the Southeast, from all the different states, as far as Louisiana, going all the way up to Kentucky, Florida, Georgia, like from everywhere. And there were these people around the event space that were actually willing to host people when they came into town. And so not only did we spend our entire day inside of this old school having conversations and having events and cooking and eating with each other and all these different kinds of things, but then we would go to our host's house after that and sleep head to toe on someone's floor who we had never met, among people who we had never met. And it was amazing. And really, I think it was a moment in anarchism that has since disappeared.
And was that around the time of all the big summit protests when that was, you know, the way that anarchists were mostly making an appearance on the public stage?
Sure. I think this would have probably been around 2006 or 7. So this would have been probably on the tail end of summit hopping and DIY punk.
Definitely.
And so it pulled influence from both of those things for sure.
And that was, so the anti-war movement was basically kicking in the gear around then, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, what that had kind of led me into is being present at George W. Bush's second inauguration protest. When my friends and I showed up there, we were tearing down all of the fences that were separating the public from the parade, and we were all rushing through the parade and being shot with pepper spray and all kinds of stuff. So it was different times for certain.
Well, so one of the things that was happening around that time is anarchists in the United States were becoming more familiar with the anarchists in Greece and in France and in Spain. That were currently active and doing things. Did that have any impact on the milieu where you were?
Yes and no. And it looks like we've probably got about, I would say, 10 or 15 more minutes. I would say yes and no, because Crime Think was an interesting group to be around in terms of its influence, because They weren't like close friends of mine. I knew Brian as an acquaintance that I had seen a number of times. Like, we recognize each other by face and by name. But at the same time, their presence had an influence on the milieu in North Carolina. And so if you really think about their transformation over the years, they went from being very post-left to being very insurrectionary and leftist, in my opinion, right? And correct. So if you can imagine at the time, this was sort of like the beginning of that transition. And so there was sort of like a very confusing mix of the two of these things that were happening at the same time. And honestly, it isn't one that I have actually been able to shake, I would say, until really just recently.
Well, so considering the time we have left, let's talk about between, you know, so that's leading up to the financial crisis. And at least for me, the financial crisis didn't really start affecting me until 2010, 2011. And then it was Occupy. So what happened with you in your neck of the woods between that early aughts era for anarchism in the United States and Occupy?
I mean, to give a quick overview of it, it was sort of the beginning, or I guess the continuation of me trying to work out this idea of taking all these legends and these myths, because again, during this time, it was like the smashing together of post-left and insurrectionaryism. And so all of these ideas of what we should be doing were being flown around, and everyone was getting into these different camps and saying, this is what we have to do. No, that's what we have to do. And so I kind of separated myself at that point from all of that and moved myself out. Mm-hmm.
Were you familiar with anarchist news around that time?
It was something that I was becoming slightly familiar with because I was part of this email list called the A-List.
Right.
I was on Twitter about the time that I moved over to the West Coast, and this very nice woman who lived in Britain and was married to this very active member on there kind of like caught wind of everything that I was putting on Twitter and invited me on there. And so I went in and ended up just raising hell and telling everyone that everything that they were thinking about in terms of the red and black was wrong, and that post-left was the only thing that we should be thinking about. And so all of these elders were just basically like, look at this fucking kid coming in here and is running his mouth. Who the fuck does he think he is? Aragorn, out of all of the people, was just kind of like, well, yeah, he's a fucking idiot, but let's listen, because it doesn't mean that he's not going to end up somewhere that's beneficial, right?
Right.
And that was kind of my introduction to A-News, was I was sort of the plast in this group and just, yeah, you know, in a rush. And basically Aragorn was the only person willing to say, no, like, let's take some time with this kid. And it placed me in his debt, so to say, in a poor choice of words, but in this format of work.
Yeah, because he's not a sailor.
No. So when I got out to the West Coast, I started experimenting with a lot of these different legends and a lot of these different things that everyone was saying, like owning the means of production and, you know, dropping out of society. So I had spent a year living without money. And then as an extension of that, I had bought a school bus off of what little money I had left in my savings, so that way I could avoid having to pay rent. So then I built this for-profit free store, which frazzled all the local anarchists in Portland, which had actually kind of been a point that I wanted to make. And again, this is a subject probably too long for the time that we have right now. But what this resulted in was me going back over to the East Coast and opening a second free store that allowed for me to be in a city of strangers, but also have a very large reputation among them, so that when the Occupy camp there began, I was already someone that people knew. And now we actually do have the 10-minute warning. So with that said, the Occupy camp I found to be pretty interesting. It was probably the birth of my new life, I would say. Like, if I had already been anarchist, I would say that was the moment where I really started to live as one. And it's a time that I wish never ended. We had a camp that lasted for 6 months uninterrupted. And we had 75 people out there every night. I have many, many tales to tell of that time, but I can't at the moment. But what I will say is that I kept my influence away from the camp as long as I possibly could, until the night when the police brought eviction notices, and that was the night that I decided to move out to camp. I put up a gigantic black flag and started calling all of my friends that I knew from around the area to come to camp and join in. We built huge barricades, and I had this moment where I realized that the people of Occupy were not anarchists. They were leftists, and they weren't ready for the kinds of proposals that I was making.
Right. So, I'm sure sometime we'll talk more about Occupy. So let's talk about from Occupy to you being on Redacted. What are some highlights from that few years?
The primary thing was that at the end of Occupy, we had taken over a house in a nearby neighborhood and moved in several important members from our Occupy camp, and had kind of deserted Occupy after we had already tanked the General Assembly and a whole lot of other really funny things. We had fake kidnapped this reporter. So we were already kind of building up this reputation around what we were doing. Okay. And without any kind of surprise to people a little bit more experienced than I was at the time, the FBI came after me. And so I skipped town when they were on the way over to my house to knock on my door, and found myself back out on the West Coast. And my life out there was a very lonely one, punctuated by infrequent meetings with people like Aragorn when he would be in town, or other anarchists here and there. And I raised money, I dated. Along the way, I ended up with the sort of white picket fence life, where my partner and I bought a house, and we had a dog, and I had a great job, and I was known in the neighborhood, and I did tons of different events in the neighborhood and all these kinds of things, but I was miserable. And so I blew up that life and moved to a different city. And upon moving to that different city, we went and visited with my friends from Occupy. And it was in that moment that I realized that having ever left that town was something I regretted, which is not something I often do in my life. And so I remember this conversation that Aragorn had when he came to Portland and he did the speaking tour. And I wish that I could remember exactly what it was that he said, but essentially it was along the lines of how he had found himself in a moment where he had to make a decision. And he had to make a decision between a life of comfort or a life among his people. And he decided to spend a life among the people that he loved, even if it meant that his life wouldn't be as comfortable as it could have been. And in that moment where I was revisiting my friends from Occupy, I had the exact same scenario in my mind. And so after a very comfortable life of 10 years in sales and marketing and entrepreneurship, I decided to throw it all away in order that I might continue to experiment with these different anarchist myths and legends and find which ones might be true and which ones might not be true. And that's Redacted. You know, that's where I found myself there is.
That's what I was just going to ask. So yeah. The last few minutes we have left, how did you wind up doing Redacted?
What I realized is that after many conversations that I've had with people in different cities and along the path, the experiences that I have are mine alone. And so they aren't things that can be copied by others. And so the only way to try and find anything workable in terms of an anarchist outlook, it has to be something that is constructed with people who have different outlooks and different experiences and backgrounds than myself. And so Redacted was kind of a construction of that. You know, it's finding people who aren't afraid to share an opinion, who aren't afraid to be unscripted, and who come from very different backgrounds than myself, whether that means age, location, income, whatever it might be. What it ended up being was three or four generations of anarchism all expressing itself on the same questions and coming up with very different answers.
All right. Well, I think that pretty much is a good summary of how Suds came to be on Redacted, including some of the entire history of your life. I'm going to hand it back to you and let you close out the show.
Yeah, it's been fun. And so next time we'll be jumping back into some of the normal subjects. So we are going to be done with the one-on-ones here. Hemlock has decided to leave the show, and so we're going to cruise with just the three co-hosts for now. And I guess the last thing that I can really say before closing out is, Anonymous, I know that you felt like you had to leave, but the front door is always open for you if you ever decide to come home.
And so is the back.
That's the time you're in my heart again. And when you go, 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 I know it never ends.
This podcast is the effort of many people. This week the podcast was sound edited by Dim. What's New was written by Jackie and read by Chisel and Dim. The editorial was written by a member of the collective. We thank Aragorn and Ariel for their help with the topics of the week. Contact us at podcast@anarchistnews.org. To learn more, anarchist and anti-political books, pamphlets, and other material are available at littleblackheart.com. For news by and or about anarchists and up-to-the-minute commentary, see you at anarchistnews.org and or the Anarchist News IRC chat room, linked on ANews.